listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
This morning, we get to dig into more history on Pilgrims, Puritans, and the founding of New England with Dr. Mackenzie. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University Chicago. You can learn more about Concordia University Chicago by visiting cuchicago.edu. Joining us today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron Mackenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Mackenzie, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here again. Thanks.
Right. So today we're picking up with Cotton Mather. Is that right? Where we left off last time?
Right. Yes, that's it. We were talking about father-son combination. The last name is Mather, M-A-T-H-E-R. And the father's first name was Increase. Yeah, literally Increase. And the son's first name was Cotton, C-O-T-T-O-N. Now, Increase, we explained last time, a typical Puritan name meant to say something about God's blessings to the community. God had given them an increase of blessings here in New England by the time Increase was born. But what about Cotton? Where did he get that name? Well, perhaps you recall at the beginning of this series, we talked a little bit about one of the great Puritan ministers in New England, and that was John Cotton, one of the first and one of the great spokesmen for the Puritan cause. Well, Increase Mather had married John Cotton's daughter, as a result of which they named their son after his maternal grandfather, namely Cotton. So Cotton Mather is the grandson on his father's side of Richard Mather and on his mother's side of John Cotton, and both Richard and John were founding pastors of Puritan New England, Massachusetts Bay in particular. So that's how he got his name. He comes from then a rich Puritan heritage. And along with his father, he attempted to hang on to Puritan fundamentals in the face of big change politically and economically that was taking place in New England. Now, his story is obviously different from his father's. Born in 1663, so he's born already after Charles II has been reestablished as king. So he never experienced the Puritan interval, never experienced Oliver Cromwell and so forth. All he ever experienced was the royal rule of New England. Nonetheless, he did live through the period of James II, Edmund Andros, the Dominion of New England, and so forth. But so he has an important history as well. He, like his father, went off to Harvard, again at the age of 12, a brilliant man. Sometimes he's described as the greatest intellect in America during the entire colonial period, very intelligent. He devoted himself to his studies, and then subsequent to his studies, to prayer and piety. At 18, he received his Master of Arts degrees from the hands of his father, Increase, who was president of Harvard by that time. Now, Mather once described his life as, quote, a continual conversation with heaven. He devoted himself to theology, religion, and ultimately to being a pastor. In spite of his great piety and great intellectual skills, he wasn't sure that he could ever really be a pastor because he had kind of a speech impediment. And it was a friend who basically just said that he should just be very deliberate in his speaking and he would be able then to communicate successfully. As a result, he did. And finally, he did overcome that impediment entirely and became a very famous and well-known preacher in New England as well. He served with his father at the Old North Church in Boston his entire ministry. And unlike his father, he never left New England. He stayed put through his entire life. He died in 1728, which means he was significantly old, in his 60s. His father died only 5 years before. So Increase and Cotton spent virtually all of his ministry, except for the last 5 years, connected to his father. And his father, of course, had a ministry prior to the birth of his son. But nonetheless, they were kind of a team. And it was as a team that they dealt with one of the great episodes in New England's religious colonial history, and that is the Salem witch trials. So I'd like to talk with you and your audience about those witch trials here for just a few minutes. The Salem witch trials, in a certain way, they are significant, but we don't want to think that what happened at Salem in Massachusetts was unprecedented and never happened anywhere else in the Christian world prior to that time. No, there were lots of episodes of witchcraft and trials of witches and witches being executed in the centuries from about the time of the Reformation up through the 17th century. That's kind of the great era of witchcraft. And people think about this a lot, about why it was at that particular time. And it's difficult really to explain. So I'm going to talk about this particular episode, which is significant in a way because it's one of the last big episodes of witchcraft in the story of Western Christianity. But as I said, it wasn't the first and by no means was the only such episode. But all right. Now, Salem is a little village, which of course has a parish church. And now I'm going to get off track here for a moment because one of the major figures in the Salem story of the Salem witchcraft was a slave girl. And we don't usually associate slavery with New England. But in fact, New England had significant slavery in the 17th and 18th centuries. Cotton Mather himself had slaves and actually wrote in defense of slavery. So it's going to take a while before slavery comes to an end in America. And it took a while even before it came to an end in New England. So there's a pastor by the name of Samuel Parris of the Salem Church, and he has a slave girl. Her name was Tituba. She was from the Caribbean, was half Caribbean, half African. She liked to play with the children of the family, and she entertained them with tales of witches and wizards, devils, and so forth, and attempted to read the future. We like to call it a crystal ball, but actually what she did was suspend the white of a raw egg in a glass of water and try to pretend that she could figure out what was going to happen on the basis of that. And the two little girls that she did this for were the 9-year-old daughter of Pastor Parris and her cousin, an 11-year-old niece of the pastor. Well, all right, Tituba has done this, the girls have gotten into it. And then subsequently, the girls began to exhibit strange symptoms. They kind of withdrew, looked preoccupied, forgetful, secretive, neglecting their chores, neglecting their prayers as well. The pastor's daughter refused the Bible when it was handed to her. They also fell into convulsions, accompanied by shrieking, tears, screams, and even unconsciousness. Well, they take the girls to the doctor. He can't find any organic reason for their problem. And so he suggests maybe there's supernatural origins going on. And Pastor Parris had already thought that might be the case. And then he's consulting with neighboring clergy, and they are coming to the conviction that this is some sort of charm or curse that's been placed upon these little girls. And then they investigate and they find out from the girls that Tituba had been showing them how to do spells and derive the future. And this convinces then the adults that they were being assaulted by witches. And the two girls confirm this. They say that they had seen the ghosts or the specters of two village women, one Sarah Good and the other Sarah Osborne, and that the specters had insisted that the girls enter a pact with the devil. And when they refused to do so, the devil afflicted them just in the ways that their parents could say, yes, they have been afflicted. Now, I want to just say something here to clarify. Throughout these trials, people who are accused or people who are afflicted will talk about the specters. And that just means the appearance of the person outside of his body. In other words, I'd be here. Well, we're actually kind of doing this through the internet, but no. But I'd really be here. And the appearance of somebody would be here in the room, and that person was actually, you know, off on the next block or something. So I'm using the word ghost, but I don't mean ghost in the sense of dead. I just mean the appearance of a person who wasn't really there. And a lot of this witchcraft evidence is about such appearances. Now, we're at a time, unlike our own, but we're at a time where people really did believe in the imminent power of the devil and of devils to do bad things in the lives of people. So a charge like this was taken very seriously. And the two women mentioned were interrogated. They denied the accusation that they were witches, but Tituba acknowledged the charge and implicated not only these two women, but two others who were also witches. The girls also identified the others as ones that they, whose specters they had seen. Hysteria starts to mount. Paris adds to the fears of the community by suggesting that the witches might be closer than anyone dared imagine. In this very church, he warned them, in this very church, God knows how many devils there are. Well, at this point, the civil authorities get into the picture. They appoint a special court, 9 prominent citizens, the governor appointed it, to investigate the charges of witchcraft. Now, I've got a few more minutes on this. Maybe we should take a break, and I'll finish it on the other side of the break.
Yeah, let's take a break right now. This is very interesting. Also, why is it always the Sarahs? I'm a little offended that both... Come on, Sarah's a good name. Anyway, you're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago. I'm thrilled to announce the Prepared to Serve Church Professional Guarantee. Any new student in one of CUC's 6 church work programs will pay no more than $5,000 in annual tuition and required fees guaranteed. Prepared to Serve is a donor-funded initiative. Support future church work students by becoming a funding partner at cuchicago.edu/prepared-to-serve. Concordia University Chicago. With Christ at the center, we stand tall for the church.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're talking about Pilgrims, Puritans, and the founding of New England, and we are in the middle of the Salem witch trials. Fascinating story, talking about specters and witches and all kinds of these things. What else do you have for us on the Salem witch trials?
Well, when the governor, the charges are becoming so serious and the number of people, so many who are involved, the governor of Massachusetts appoints this special committee, and it consists of 9 very prominent citizens. The lieutenant governor presides over the committee, and they are charged with acting on these accusations and getting to the bottom of this. So they do. And the committee investigates and accepts the evidence of specters, spectral evidence. And on that basis, imprison over 150 suspected witches. And the idea was that your specter could not be out there doing bad things unless you were approving of that. So that was something that a witch could do, use its specter to afflict people, even if the witch wasn't personally present. So we've got 150 suspects. 19 of them were found guilty and hanged. One of them was actually a Congregationalist minister, a fellow by the name of George Burroughs, who by that time was living in Maine, but he was charged, brought back, thrown into jail, and found guilty. Besides the 19 who were hanged, another one by the name of Giles Corey was pressed to death. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in order to get him to talk, they took him out to a field and piled heavy stones on him. Now, the idea was if you talked, you might get off. But if you confessed, you might get off. But if you were found guilty, that would mean loss of all your property and so forth. So he refused to answer, and they kept piling rocks on him. His last words were supposed to have been, "More weight," which they did, and he died. And he died. Now, most of the victims were middle-aged women, although, as I've just indicated, there were some men. Lots of them were social misfits, kind of people who had this reputation of being eccentric. They're probably poor, either widowed, never married. Or on the other side of the scale, that is social elites. So you either had the misfits or you had very prominent people, and some of them from families in Salem who were opposed to Parris's ministry. Now, the evidence included the confessions. If you confess, you could get off. Also, physical evidence, witches' paraphernalia, like voodoo dolls. Also, marks on a body, something like bumps of flesh, which they called the witch's tit, where the devil sucked. There were evidence from victims of being harmed by spells and curses of the accused. There was all this spectral evidence. And lots of the spectral evidence occurred right in court when people who were being interrogated claimed to be under assault of the devil. And there were these men who were present. Nobody else could see them. And of course, there were also all these unusual reactions, the cries, the contortions, and so forth. Now, neither Increase nor Cotton Mather was right there in Salem. So they and other clergy were simply consulted as to whether these things could be real and also whether the spectral evidence should be accepted. Well, the clergy, including Increase and Cotton, you know, the leading clergy of Massachusetts, initially thought that the government should take steps to rid the land of witches, so that on the basis of the evidence that they had heard about, it was right to proceed. But then as the executions kept getting larger and the charges expanding, there was even a rumor that the governor's wife was involved, Increase Mather led 14 of his fellow clergy to urge a halt in the proceedings. He published a sermon, Increase did, called Cases of Conscience. And this argued that the proceedings were based too much on spectral evidence. And spectral evidence was evidence which only the victim could see. So there's no way of kind of checking that out. Moreover, they argued that the devil could impersonate innocent persons as well as guilty persons. So how could you use that to convict somebody whose specter had appeared? Increase Mather went on to argue that one should not use supernatural evidence like specters, but evidence of the sort used for other crimes, like confessions that were not compelled, or the testimony of two credible witnesses. So Increase Mather wrote, "It were better that 10 suspected witches escape than that one innocent person should be condemned." Well, intervention of Increase Mather and his fellow clergy was enough for the governor. He dismissed the special committee or court, if you will. He freed on bail many of those who were imprisoned, and he urged the judges to find other ways of relieving the remaining prisoners from their sentence. To the lieutenant governor's dismay, because this was his committee, there were no more executions. And in May of the next year, Governor Phipps granted a general pardon to all of those who had been arrested. Very interestingly, a few years later, the Chief Justice of Massachusetts, who'd been on this committee, this is Samuel Sewall, very interesting guy, he publicly repented of his participation in these trials, and he wrote an apology of repentance and had it read aloud in church by his pastor while he stood at his pew with his head hung in shame. Now, what's the significance of this? Well, you could say it was the last gasp of the pre-modern world. From this time forward, people increasingly didn't believe in witches. And that may very well be true, because we're on the cusp of actually getting involved in the first stages of the scientific enlightenment, when that meant people began to look for secondary causes of bad things as opposed to an immediate cause from the devil. On the other hand, Cotton Mather did not sign his father's sermon. Cotton, who himself was interested in science, he advocated the smallpox inoculation, for example. And nonetheless, he believed in the reality of witches, and he gave evidence of very strange things that he had seen for which he could come up with no other explanation than it was really the work of the devil. These days, historians have tried various explanations. Some have argued what I'll call the medical model, that there was an abnormal psychology that took hold of the community on a wide scale. Others have said that at least initially this began with some conscious fraud, a way of some people getting back at other people by charging them falsely. And he argues that this helps to explain some of the evidence that is otherwise unexplainable, namely that some of the victims had their hands tied behind their back. Now, how did that happen if there wasn't some human connivance in it? Well, some would have said that's what the devil did. There was also a social explanation. If you look at the geography of who was accused and who did the accusing, it was mostly people from the west side who accused people from the east side. And that in turn reflected longstanding conflicts over money and power. And then there is the explanation of that women alone, as I mentioned before, widows, or the never married, women without men, who were already had kind of an awkward spot in the community. It was easy to accuse them of being witches as opposed to anybody else. May or may not work, because of course you did have men who were accused as well. And then finally, as I said, it is possible that at least some of this stuff really was authentic, that there were witches in league with the devil. And I don't know that at this point we will ever, ever know. All right. You guys got any questions or comments on this?
Wow. I don't know if I have any questions. It's nice to hear it from a historical perspective rather than just how Hollywood presents it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, well, there was a very famous play called it's an Arthur Miller play. I'm not remembering what it was, but he used it as a metaphor for the anti-communist hearings in Congress. And so you could use this in various ways to make various points. And that's what Hollywood and novelists like to do.
The Crucible.
Crucible, that's it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
It. I didn't know I had to Google.
Fair oh, good. Well, okay. All right. That's all right. And so it used to be in my class when I would say something, nobody would know the answer and we'd have to look it up. But now I pause for like 10 seconds and bingo, somebody's got an answer.
Somebody's got the answer. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Oh, so much history. We have more to learn next time. Our guest for this series, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, thanks for joining us today.
I was glad to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.